Hello, this is Chris Long with the 8th episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. It is incredible. In Paradise, Florida, the bodies just seem to be piling up. John Pulla is now working with the chief of police to see if they can make some sense out of all these killings. Chapter 57. The small shack sat behind an abandoned-looking building 10 blocks off the water. It was in an area that would be discreetly described as a transitional stage, meaning don't go there at night and also try to avoid it during the day. The place looked dead and wasted, and nothing like paradise in its emerald beaches relatively close by. It seemed that the town's beauty was only skin deep. A few layers under the surface, it became quite ugly. 3 young men were standing outside the building and taking turns tossing knives at tin cans set atop a dumpster. They were good enough that each one consistently knocked the cans over from a distance of 10 feet. Decent aim. The men whirled, their hands dipping to the guns in their waistbands, and then they stopped reaching for their guns. Puller stood there holding an MP5 set on 2-shot bursts. Carson had not been kidding about weapons, and flying on military transport had allowed her to bring whatever guns she wanted. "Wise decision," said Puller, coming forward and lifting his gaze past them into the windows of the shack. They were covered, and he saw no one trying to peek through to get a sight line on him with the weapon. "Got a question?" The men looked at him warily. Puller could tell they were trying to think of some way to turn this tactical advantage into a disadvantage, but he wasn't worried because the MP5 at close quarters was a difficult nut to crack. "His name is Diego. He has 2 cousins, Isabel and Mateo. Where are they?" The man said nothing. "Diego, Isabel, and Mateo. Where are they?" The man remained silent. Puller moved a foot closer. With one sweep of the MP, he could lay all 3 down for eternity. He shifted the fire selector on the MP to full auto. "I'll ask one more time, and then I won't ask again." "We don't know where they are," said one of the men, staring at the muzzle of the MP. "But you did know, right?" The 3 men looked at one another. The man who had spoken shrugged. "Hard to say." "No, it's really not. You just have to say it." Puller moved another foot closer. The man smiled. Puller thought he knew why. "I wouldn't," said Puller. "I'm not the only one here." The man stopped smiling. It was in the corner of Puller's eye, a 4th man. He'd come around the building's east side. He had a slim, compact pistol aimed at Puller's head. "Check your chest," said Puller. The man flinched, looked nervous, but didn't look down, obviously suspecting a trick. The other men glanced over. The man who had spoken swore under his breath as he saw the red dot squarely over the man's hat. He said something in Spanish. The man with the gun looked down, saw the dot he swore to, lowered his gun. Puller pointed his MP at him. "Why don't you lose the gun and join the discussion group?" It wasn't a question. The man dropped his gun and walked over to the others, the red dot following him the whole way. "Diego and his cousins. They were here, and now they're not. So where did they go?" The 4 men glanced nervously at one another. "Glancing and not talking tends to make me very angry," said Pola. "And when I get angry, I do unpredictable things." He put the fire selector back on 2-shot bursts and fired some rounds above their heads. They all instinctively dropped to the dirt. Pola eased his finger off the trigger and said, "Where?" "They took them." One of the other men glared at him and looked ready to punch his colleague. The speaker sensed this, but hurried on. "They were taken last night. The man paid $1,000 for them both." "Both? Which both?" "Los Ninos, Diego and Mateo." "Who paid $1,000?" Puller said sharply. "Like I said, an hombre." 2 of the other men hissed, but the speaker looked defiantly back at them. Puller said, "What was his name? What did he look like?" Before the other man could answer, there was a roaring sound. Puller looked to his left and saw the pickup trucks coming. In the truck beds were men standing and holding a lot of firepower and looking ominously in Puller's direction. In Puller's earwig, Carson's voice cracked. "I think retreat is the order of the day," she said. Puller grabbed the man who had answered him, and they ran off. The trucks veered off to give chase, but several shots rang out and both trucks ground to a halt with flattened tires. Two men fell out of one truck bed as it screeched to a stop. Puller turned the corner with the man in tow and saw the Tahoe up ahead. He double-timed it and saw Carson coming down from her high perch on another building carrying her scoped rifle. She jumped into the passenger seat. Puller threw the man into the rear seat and leapt into the driver's seat as he heard feet pounding down the road and men yelling in Spanish. He hit the gas and the Tahoe sped off, turned a corner, and disappeared in the maze of streets. Carson had her rifle pointed at the man in the back seat. She studied him calmly. "What man took the boys?" Puller glanced at her. "I heard over your earwig." She looked at the man in the back seat. "We need some details." The man shook his head. "You've come this far," said Carson. "In for a dime, in for a dollar." The man looked at Puller. "You are big, like the other guy." Puller glanced at him in the rear view. "What other guy?" "The big guy, bigger than you. He can fight." "Is he staying at the Sierra?" The man nodded. "He picked up one of our guys like he was nothing, threw a knife 20 feet, point first into a wall. El Diablo." Puller glanced at Carson. "The same guy who saved my butt the other night." Carson looked at the man. "El Diablo have a real name?" "No sé." "Is he the one who took Los Ninos? "No." "Who did then?" "No sé." Carson moved her finger closer to the trigger of her rifle. A smile crept across the man's face. "You won't shoot me." "Why?" "Because you are military, a general." Carson looked down at the one-star ring she had on. "Man said, I was in the military once, not yours, from my country." "Sorry to see you've fallen so low," snapped Carson. "We want to help Diego and Mateo, that's all. Help us do that. They're just kids. They are beyond help." "You don't know that." "I know that, and I don't care. They're not my problem." Carson looked at Puller and shrugged. "Open the door," she said. The man said, "What?" "Open your door and jump." "What?" "Jump." She pointed her gun at his crotch. "General or not, you jump now or you'll be missing some very vital parts." The man kicked open the door and leapt out, tumbling along the road and then coming to a stop. They watched as he picked himself up and slowly limped off. Puller said, "I like your style." Carson eyed him with a stern gaze. "What?" he said. "Next time you go on R&R, pick a safer place than paradise." His phone buzzed. He answered it and listened for a bit before saying, "Okay." Then he clicked off. Carson said, "Talk to me. I've been officially invited to join the murder investigation." Chapter 58. Mako studied the police officers. He was bagging yard debris, and the police officers were bagging the remains of a very expensive automobile. Mako wondered if they had found the bits of the license plate with the man on it. He hoped not. He hoped it had been blown into the water and swallowed by a shark. As he used a rake to collect some dead branches that had fallen to the ground, he watched the maid Beatrice walk across the lawn with a tray of lemonade and snacks. She was headed to the pool where Lambert and James Winthrop and Chrissy Murdoch were lounging. Her eyes were puffy, and she kept her gaze downcast as she served the drinks and food. He watched Lambert eye her as she walked back across the lawn. As she neared the house, he was out of sight of the others. Mako hoisted the bag of debris and used his long legs to reach a spot that would cross her path. She pulled up when she saw him. He was well over a foot taller than her and more than twice her weight. He spoke to her in Spanish, asking her if everything was okay. She mumbled that it was and kept walking. He kept pace beside her. He asked more questions and finally queried Beatrice about her employer. Her features hardened. Mako pounced on this vulnerability. "I understand that your boss is leaving the country soon." She looked at him sharply. "How do you know that?" "One of his guys told me. Asia and Africa. At least that's what I overheard." "When does he leave?" "Why do you want to know?" "I was thinking of asking you out. It would probably be easier if he weren't around." Whether she understood the significance of his words or not, it was impossible to tell from her features. "You want to ask me out?" "I wasn't always a laborer. I treat women with respect and courtesy." "It is impossible." "I understand." She put a hand on his arm. "No, you do not understand. I am not allowed to leave the premises." "You cannot leave here?" She shook her head and said in a low voice, "It is not permitted. I should not even be talking to you. I am a nobody. They do not care about nobodies. I think you are somebody. Is it the gods that keep you in here?" "No, not just the gods." She glanced over her shoulder in the direction of the pool. "You could call the police." She shook her head. "No, why not? It is not just me. I don't understand. There are others. Your family?" She nodded, tears trickling from her eyes. She picked up her pace and hurried across the lawn and into the house. Mako slowed his walk and ambled over to the truck with his load of debris. He dumped it in the vehicle's rear bed and watched as Lambert walked down to the gate that led to the pier and unlocked the gate. The walls back here were wrought iron, 6 feet high. Lambert obviously didn't worry too much about prying eyes from the water. There was enough foliage to block the main house and guest house from observers on boats. Mako continued to watch as Lambert walked down the pier, climbed on board the yacht, and disappeared below decks. I could kill him, and maybe I should. But Mako didn't move toward the boat. Part of it was practical. He counted 5 security guards within his sight line. He had no way to easily get through the gate, and he also had no weapon. Each time they had come here, every man on the landscape crew had to walk through a magnometer, and then he was warned by the security detail. Lambert was a careful man. Before he even got to the big boat, they would have shot him. And what would that have accomplished? No, better to let the plan play out than the way he had envisioned. As he continued to work under a hot sun, he thought about what the man Donnie had told him last night at the hotel. The shipments came nearly every night. The last platform used as a staging area was 20 miles off the coast and to the west. Mako believed that was the one he'd been on. Mako had also been told that the plan was to start smuggling even more people in beginning next month. This would include people from Asia and Africa. This made sense if Lambert were planning to travel to those continents. How soon he would be leaving could be problematic. If things were not in place and he left before Mako could act, "I will not let that happen, even if I have to somehow shoot his plane out of the sky. He will not get away again, never again." Mako sensed someone watching him and turned to see Chrissy Murdoch staring at him from just off the pool deck. She had on a bikini with a short terry cloth cover-up over it. He continued to work away as she walked over to him. He knelt down and pulled at some weeds around a flower bed. He saw her painted nose stop a few inches from him. He looked up. "Mako, yes, you work very hard." He shrugged as he threw the weeds into a sack he had taken from the truck. "The only way I know, hard." She smiled at this as though the comment had amused her somehow. "Did you hear what happened last night?" Mako didn't look up. It was beyond odd that she was talking to him at all, and particularly about bombs exploding in the darkness. "I saw the car, and you saw me too, didn't you?" He looked at her. "I do not understand. At the window of the guest house yesterday morning, you were looking. I saw your reflection in the mirror hanging on the wall." "Ugh," thought Mako. "It's okay. I'm not upset or anything. Did you like what you saw?" Was she playing with him? Yet for some reason he thought she really wanted to hear the answer. "Do you like what you are doing?" he shot back. "It's complicated." "Complex things are actually simple." "Oh, you think so, don't you?" "Maybe. What do you think? Did I like it?" "No, but then again, it's none of my business." She looked over his shoulder in the yacht. "He was the best of, has the best of everything, houses, planes, yachts, and you are one, are you one of his best? You don't seem like a typical member of a landscaping crew. I came here for a better life. I have yet to find it. In my country, I had a good job. I used my brains. Here, I just used my back." "So why come here, then?" "I had to." "Were things bad in your country?" "Things were bad." "I see." "Do you really see?" She looked at him with a bemused expression. "Why do I think you're talking more about me than you? Does the other man know? James? James is lock, stock, and barrel with Peter." "This is a phrase I don't understand. Peter owns James, so no, he doesn't care. Then James is less than a man, a fact I know perfectly well. Why do you bother to talk to me? Because I saw? I trust my gut on people, and you pass that test. That doesn't matter. People like you do not talk to people like me. Is that the rule? Yes. I like to smash rules, Mako. I always have. He shrugged and went back to weeding. Will you be here much longer? She asked. Will you? I don't know. It's up to Peter. The same for me, thought Mako. Chapter 59. The Plaza Hotel did not look like the far more famous one in New York City on the edge of Central Park. Its exterior was the usual beige stucco, its roof the usual terracotta tiles, and each balcony overlooking the water had columns shaped like palm trees. Puller did not focus on the architecture of the building as he and Carson walked inside. He was thinking about Diego and how to get him and Mateo back in something other than body bags, and he still had no clue where Isabel was. "Do we tell the police about what just happened?" asked Carson as they hurried through the ornate lobby that had, as its centerpiece, a fountain with King Neptune in the center on a pedestal, with dolphins and mermaids leaping around him. If it weren't so garish, it might have actually been funny. "Yes, we do. They need to get an APB out on the kids right now." Landry met him at the elevator banks, and they rode a car up to the floor where the murders had occurred. On the way, Puller told her about Diego and Mateo and their run-in with the street kings. "You're lucky to still be walking around. Those guys are real animals." "They wouldn't last a minute in Afghanistan," said Puller. "Amen to that," said Carson. Landry called in this information. "I'll let you know as soon as we hear anything," she said after she got off the phone. As they climbed off the elevator, Puller caught Landry and Carson checking each other out in a way only women could do and most men would never even notice. But Puller noticed, and again it made him uncomfortable. The hotel room was empty except for Bullock and the two dead bodies. Other than that, there was no visible sign that anything had been processed. Bullock came over to them, and as if in answer to his thoughts, he said, "Called in some support from the state police, and I'm trying to think of a way to engage the FBI. This is getting out of control, but I've heard nothing back yet. Florida's slashed its budget like every other state. Not sure we're going to be getting any help." Puller was only half listening. His attention was on the bed where the two men lay. He drew closer, Carson right next to him. "Who called it in?" "Hotel. Room service came up here with a breakfast order one of the guys had put in the night before. No one answered. She opened the door and, to put it delicately, tossed her cookies along with the breakfast tray. Luckily, someone cleaned that up before we got here." "Those wounds look deep." "They are. The knife blade came out the other side of both men." "Long blade and strong killer," said Puller. He focused more on the faces. He had already seen that the two men were not the same pair that had been following him. When Carson asked him about this, he shook his head. "No, different guys, never seen them before." He looked at Landry. "Time of death?" "The ME came in and did a quick look-see and pronounced death. She said between 2 and 4 last night." Puller ran his gaze over the bodies. "Tied up." He looked closer at their faces. "Were their mouths taped? I see some residue." "Apparently so, but the killer took the tape with him. And there's this." Landry edged down the pants and underwear of one of the men. "The killer cut his groin?" Landry nodded. "We saw the blood on the pants, and the MB took a look." "Torture? Getting them to talk?" "I guess that technique would work on most guys," observed Landry dryly. "Who are these two?" "Joe Watson is the guy on the right. This was his room. Stiff on the left is Donald Target. He was in the room next door." "What else do we know about them?" "Not much. They came down here about 2 weeks ago. They're both from New Jersey. We're checking into their backgrounds now, next of kin being notified, all the standard stuff." "2 weeks here," said Puller. "Pretty expensive." "It can be, yes," said Landry. "Nice suit," said Carson, edging up Watson's jacket to see the lapel. "Hands manicured, expensive shoes. There's money here for sure." Puller came over to join them. "And a bombing at Lambert's place, murders on the beach, gangs attacking folks. I don't know what the hell is going on. Just last week, this place was a peaceful as a small town in the middle of Kansas. Even small towns have problems, said Pulla, thinking of his recent escapade in rural West Virginia. Well, right now I'll switch with any of them, replied Bullock. He looked inquiringly at Carson, and Pulla quickly introduced her. A general? That's pretty impressive. Not really. The Army has a lot of one-stars. Not many who are women, I bet. The Army could definitely do better in that regard, agreed Carson. Pulla said, any leave behinds from the killer? Not much so far. No one saw anything. And unfortunately, the hotel doesn't have security cameras in the corridors. Why not? What happens in paradise stays in paradise, replied Bullock. Vegas has tons of surveillance cameras, she pointed out, in the casinos, and I guess we're a little more forgiving here. Not very forgiving to those two, said Pulla, pointing at the dead man. How's the investigation coming with your aunt? Asked Landry. It's coming. Did you ever find Jane Ryan? She wasn't at her home. We left messages on her phone for her to contact us. How about an APB? We don't have enough cause to issue an APB. We just saw her driving down the street. She could have been coming from anyone's home or just passing through the neighborhood. We learned she has other clients on that street, and the ME has not issued her report yet. We don't even know if it was a murder. So you're just going to wait to hear from her? And if you don't, if she's already fled the country? You can put markers in the system for passport, credit card, and cell phone usage. She can be tracked that way. Bullock looked doubtful. I'll need a court order for that. Let's just try to work the case a bit more. I don't want to get my butt in sued in case she's just off on vacation or something. And now I've got all this to deal with. This, we know, was a murder. Pulla turned back to the bodies on the bed. What do you want me to do? You're a trained investigator. Look around and tell me if you see anything that strikes you. I've got my evidence duffel in my car. If I'm going to look around, I'd rather do it my way and professionally. Hell, have at it. I'm not proud to admit I'm out of my depth here. Pulla left to get his duffel. Chapter 60. 4 hours later, Pulla rose off one knee and bagged one more piece of evidence. He gave all the bags to Landry and slipped off his latex gloves and booties. Carson, Landry, and Bullock had watched Pulla methodically work the crime scene, taking photos, measuring, dusting for prints, and generally scrubbing the room for any clues to the killer's identity. He had done both this room and the one next door. Army trained you well, John, said Carson, looking impressed as he tossed his gloves and booties into his duffel. Yes, they did, John, Landry added hastily. Pulla tried not to think about the increasingly complex situation with the two women as he packed his tools away. Bullock was sitting on the edge of a credenza. While Pulla had worked away, Landry went for sandwiches and waters. They had eaten outside the room at Pulla's insistence so as not to contaminate the crime scene. Any conclusions? Got a partial footprint near the edge of the bed in the other room. Dirt pattern that was probably carried in from outside. No obvious smells. Killer probably wasn't wearing any type of strong cologne that might have lingered. I did elimination prints on the dead guys. Those are most of the prints I found in the rooms. I would assume some others match hotel personnel. For elimination purposes, we'll need to print any of them who came up here, unless it was someone working at the hotel who killed them. Right, then we'll need to print all of them. We'll get right on that. He nodded at Landry, who walked out to get it done. Pulla swept his gaze around the room. Anything else? Not forensically. I think we'll know more when we find out about the dead guy's backgrounds. These aren't street bangers, but you have drug problems here, right? What city doesn't have drug problems? Any other issues here we should know about? Carson looked at Pulla and then at Bullock. The police chief stared back at the CID agent. Like what? I don't know. That's why I'm asking you. You know this town better than I do. There's nothing special about paradise in the crime department. In fact, before this last wave of violence, we were pretty clean. Pulla glanced at Carson. Bullock caught his look and said, you know something I don't. People disappear here, Puller asked. Disappear? What the hell do you mean? Spontaneous combustion? Do they live here one day and then they're gone the next? Missing persons? No, we don't get much of that. How many folks here are undocumented illegals? This is a beach town on the Gulf, unprotected border, tourist destination, cheap labor is important, meaning you have a lot of undocumented. I wouldn't say a lot, but if they went missing, you wouldn't necessarily hear about it. I mean, folks might not report it. I guess they might not, but what are you getting at? When I find out, I'll let you know. I'll fill you in, Chief, said Landry. Some kids are missing. We have an APB out on them. Before Bullock could react to this, Puller hefted his duffel over his shoulder and looked at Carson. You ready? Let's go. You're just going to leave it at that, said Bullock. I came down here to find out why my aunt died. I intend to finish that mission. And all the other stuff that's going on, if it's connected to what happened to my aunt, then that too. He motioned with his hand to the bed. You might want to get them out of here. The smell is only going to get more unpleasant, especially in this heat. Carson followed him out as Bullock stood in the middle of the room looking at the dead men. Puller loaded his duffel into the Tahoe and climbed into the driver's side while Carson got in the passenger seat. Landry hurried up to them. Are you heading out? She asked. For now, yeah. Are you getting the elimination prints done? Organizing it right now. Let me know when you find out anything about the two stiffs. They weren't down here for vacation. I will. Landry glanced at Carson and then back at Puller. You have time to get together later? Puller licked his lips and felt the heat rise to his face. That's a possibility. I'll give you a call. Landry looked like she'd been slapped and she glanced once more at Carson. Are you at the Gulf Coast? At first, Puller thought she was asking him, but then it became clear she wasn't. Carson said, yes, just checked in. I assume you're down here on vacation. I am. Then you might want to try a place closer to the beach. The Gulf is a long walk, and you don't want to miss any rays. Thanks for the advice. You're welcome, she said curtly, and then turned and stalked off. Am I interrupting something? Carson said. Puller put the Tahoe in gear and backed out of the space. No, he said. Okay, where are we going? You want to hit the beach? Is that what you want to do? She asked, looking surprised. No, but I'm here working. You're not. I'm not a sun worshiper, and I'm here because you're here. So let's get to work. All right, so where to? Where it all started. My aunt's house. Chapter 61. What are you looking for? Carson was staring at Puller, who was searching through his aunt's closet. Things that aren't here. He went back outside, dug through his duffel, and pulled out the stapled piece of paper, rifling through them. He counted down the items on the list and nodded his head. Breakthrough? You could say that. Puller slid the papers into his pocket and stared over at Cookie's house. Yellow police tape was still up, but there was no police cruiser packed out front. They were probably over at the new crime scene at the plaza. John, what's going on? Just trying to piece something together. About the murders? Maybe, maybe not. She followed as he walked over to Cookie's house and through the gate into the backyard. The house was dark. The door was locked. 10 seconds later, the door was no longer locked. Army teach you that, she whispered, whispered Carson over his shoulder as he eased the door open. Army taught me a lot of things, most of them useful. She followed him inside. While I'm here, I might as well get some stuff for the dog. He opened some cabinets in the kitchen, found the doggy supplies, and piled them in a plastic bag he pulled from the recycling bin next to the pantry door. So you just came for the dog stuff? Asked Carson. Puller didn't answer. He went over to the cabinet housing. Cookie's watch collection. He counted off again. This is getting to be a little tiresome, Puller, Carson said, a bite in her tone. Just trying to add up the pieces before arriving at a course of action. And those figures and all, and those figure in all this somehow? She pointed to the watches. They figure in something, but we've got one more place to check. He looked at his watch. It's still too early yet, but we've got some time to kill. Let's take a drive. Where? Not where, really, more like far. How far? 5 miles. They left Cookie's house and climbed back into the Tahoe. Puller checked the rear view. See the two guys anywhere? No, but I didn't expect to, really. He looked at his odometer. Okay, 5 miles out, 5 miles back. We're going to head east. At least that seems to be the direction based on what Jane Ryan told me. They left Orion Street and then the community of Sunset by the Sea. 3 miles out, they left any semblance of civilization behind. 4 miles out, it was only them, the sand, and the ocean. 5 miles out, Puller stopped the truck and looked around. They were on the main street. To the north looked busier, with some buildings visible in the distance. To the south was a row of palm trees. The ocean has to be on the other side of those trees, said Puller. Provides a natural screen from the road, observed Carson. They pulled down a side road and quickly found that beyond the trees was a section of thick brush, more trees, and some surface roads running through them, and then the sand, and then the ocean. Puller swung the Tahoe to a stop on an asphalt pack-off, and they climbed out. He looked in all directions except toward the ocean. Pretty isolated, he said. No people. I wonder why. The beach looks pretty enough. They walked toward it and quickly found out why the beach was not very popular. The sand was gritty. The beach was covered with sharp rocks, and then there was the smell. Carson covered her nose. Sulfur. Must be some geological quirk around here that makes this stretch of beach the way it is. And then there's that. He pointed a large sign erected on the dune. It read, warning, strong riptide, no swimming allowed. So not all of paradise is a paradise, said Carson. I think we might have left paradise about a half mile ago. Not sure what this place is called. Maybe it's nothing. It's a wonder that sulfur smell doesn't foul up the other beaches. Wind probably doesn't carry it that far, said Paula, or there might be some sort of meteorological reason. I didn't smell the sulfur until we got near the beach. Me either, come to think of it. But why in the world would your aunt come here? I don't know. She was old, disabled, used a walker. So walking on a beach like this would be problematic. I've almost fallen twice. They stopped and looked around. Puller fixed his gaze directly out at the ocean. Any shipping channels out there? I don't know. It's the Gulf of Mexico. I would imagine there are lots of ships coming and going. And then there are all the oil drilling platforms. Right, like the one that popped and kept spewing oil for a long time. I remember when the BP well burst open, J2 was tracking it for security reasons, and we did some background on the area. There are thousands of oil platforms out there. Most of them are concentrated off the coasts of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, but some extend over into the Panhandle. Oil is king, at least for now, yeah. Carson bent down, picked up a chunk of rock, and tossed it into the waves. Can we go? I'm about to puke with this smell, and I need a shower to get the stink off. A lot of smells more gross than this in the military, said Polo dryly. True, but that doesn't mean I have to endure them when I'm on vacation. They walked back to the Tahoe. Before they got in, Polo stopped and knelt down. What is it? The king. Excuse me? She walked around to join him. He ran his finger over the asphalt, and it turned black. He lifted his finger to his nose and looked up at her. Oil, not from a platform, from a vehicle. Chapter 62. Mako walked the lawnmower up the ramp of the truck and positioned it next to two other pieces of motorized equipment. He turned and stared back out across the Lambert estate. He didn't know how much the man spent on landscaping, but it must be a lot. They had come every day and worked all day. When one part was done, it was time to move on to another. When the cycle was complete, it started over again. When he had asked the foreman about it, the man had just shaken his head and muttered, "He spends more on grass than I'll make in my entire life. What's fair about that?" "Life is not meant to be fair," Mako had told him. "You got that right. Life is meant to suck, unless you're rich. There are things other than money to bring happiness. Keep telling yourself that, you might actually start believing it." "I do believe it," Mako had said after the man walked off. Mako climbed down and washed the back of his neck with cold water from a bucket carried on the truck. He glanced toward the yacht. Lampert had never come back off it. He had been on there most of the day, but then again, when he had a yacht like that, why would you get off? Then Mako wondered if he were there by himself. He doubted it. He knew that Chrissy Murdoch was not there. He had seen her go into the house. The maid Beatrice had not gone out there either. But there were other women here, and one could have arrived directly at the yacht from the waterside via a tender, and Mako would not have been able to see it. The yacht blocked the water view along its full length. Mako walked back over at the guest house and then at the remains of the Bentley. The police had finally left, apparently having exhausted the evidence remaining at the crime scene. Actually, they would not find any, because he had not left any. If they were looking for a bomb signature, they would not find one. He had gone totally generic on that. It would provide them with 1,000 possible paths to go down, with nary a viable prosecution case at the end of any of them. He looked up in time to see the sun reflecting off something in an upstairs room of the main house. He immediately walked in the opposite direction, took cover behind a tree, and knelt down, ostensibly to look for weeds to pull or mulch to tidy up. From the partial cover provided by the tree canopy, he looked up, shielding the sun's glare with one of his huge hands. He counted windows, the second window from the left, southwestern side of the house. He squinted to see if he could tell who was holding the optics, but he couldn't make out the wrong person. He ran a sight line from the window to what the person was looking at. It was a simple process and yielded a simple answer, the yacht. With decent optics and from that height, the person could probably make out quite a few details on the boat, which also meant the person was well ahead of Mako when it came to recon. He saw Beatrice come out again. Mako moved swiftly enough to intersect her path. He walked along with her for a few paces. He asked the questions that he needed answers. She didn't seem to want to, perhaps thinking he was casing the place for a later burglary, but finally she did tell him. Mako thanked her and said that he would try to help her. How? I can get you out, perhaps. You cannot do that. My family. I know, it's complicated. It is not complicated. Do not do anything to help me. I am beyond help. She turned and rushed off. Mako looked around to see if this conversation had engaged the interest of anyone, security types or otherwise. He could see no one paying any attention. They were merely servants conversing. Perhaps it was expected. Class to class. It was only when you tried to mingle outside your class, steerage passengers emerging on the main decks during daylight hours, that people became upset. But she had told him what he needed to know. The room with the optics belonged to Christine Murdoch. She was the one spying on Lampert and his yacht. And Mako wondered why that was so. Chapter 63. Peter Lampert sat back in the leather chair that was located in his private office on Lucky Lady. He was surrounded by only the best here, the best boat, the best equipment, the best crew, the best wine, the best views, and the best-ass money you could buy. It had been a long slog for him, though. South Beach was a rough place to survive, much less build a successful business. Lampert had tried the legitimate side for a long time, but ultimately he found it too stifling with all its rules and regulations and laws that could trip you up. He did not like regulatory agencies looking over his shoulder. He didn't know of one businessman who did. After his hedge fund had imploded, he had decided to build a different business model. Thus he had taken his talents to another line of work. He had installed proven business systems in a field that often existed on crude violence and sketchy accounting. Now he had built an incredibly profitable empire by charging fees tied to profitability, like royalties on a book. He charged a standard fee up front to find and transport product to the end user. If the product hit certain benchmarks once deployed in the field, Additional money started to flow back to him. If a prostitute reaped over six figures, then money started to come back to him. If a drug mule successfully completed 10 missions, money started to flow back to him. The lowest level product, the common laborer, typically had a more modest threshold to meet because of their initial cost was the least. But the profits generated by them added up because there were so many of them deployed in the field. Volume was volume. Slave labor in civilized countries was one of the fastest growing segments of the criminal world. Not that he ever saw anything remotely criminal about it. To Lambert, he was doing these poor folks a favor. As slaves, they were fed and housed and lived a decent life, despite the fact that they were not free. He had often had these people taken from worlds where there were never enough to eat, never a roof over their heads, and where wages were something one dreamt about but never actually received. Freedom was vastly overrated in his mind. He had accountants placed in strategic areas with full access to the books of his business associates. These associates, often not the most cooperative men, had fallen in line with his demands solely because he had made the business far more lucrative and stable than it had ever been before, and he guaranteed a steady stream of product across all service lines. That was the most crucial factor in his business, and it demanded constant foraging for bodies in some of the most remote places on earth. There was no margin of error in this segment of the business. As a result, a boat that was late with product was a boat that would not be sitting above the water much longer, along with its captain and crew. He took out the starboard window and checked his watch. Then he glanced back at the computer screen, over which a stream of business data poured over secure networks. He played hard, but he also worked hard. It was not easy building what he had. Most people would not have the nerve or stomach for it. He had been born with a silver spoon in his mouth on the shores of Lake Michigan. His father had been CEO of a Fortune 500 company. His mother was a beautiful socialite who entertained often and lavishly at their multiple homes. They had lived the life that most Americans dreamed of. He had gone to the most elite universities and set up shop on Wall Street, along with a gaggle of his classmates. Many were now titans of industry and preferred to keep the money and influence that came with it in tightly controlled circles of people who were just like them. Upward mobility was nice to talk about to the masses, but not something that people at his level ever really took seriously. The pie was only so big. Why share it with folks who do not share your values, your vision for the future, your fraternity affiliation? What most people didn't understand was that it was the risk-takers who made America great. It was said that the rich had captured nearly all the wealth and all of the income generated over the last decade or so. Well, Lambert thought they should. It was right and just. The only thing wrong with income inequality was that it wasn't unequal enough. The 99.9%ers were sheep and stuck right where they should be. They were the players to be named later. There were billions and billions of them, and they looked exactly the same. The 0.1%ers deserved everything because they were the elites. They were special. They moved the world to new heights, and it didn't deter Lambert in the least that he was acting on the wrong side of the law. People wanted whores and drugs and slave laborers. Thus, there was a need. He was simply fulfilling that need. Nothing more, nothing less. Like cigarette manufacturers, porn sites, fast food outlets, and casinos fed people's desires and addictions, that simple model had driven business success for all of recorded history. Find a need and fill it as hard as you can. 10 minutes later, he checked his watch again and looked out the window. It was growing dark. That was good. An hour later, he heard the thump, thump. He rose and looked out the window. The lights of the chopper were drawing closer, coming in from the gulf, where a boat larger than the one Lambert was on lay at anchor. A few minutes later, he felt the wheels of the Bird come to rest on the helipad at the aft of the yacht. The chopper powered down, and he could envision, but not hear, over the sounds of the engine, the doors of the aircraft opening and then thunking closed. He sat back down in his chair, put his fingers together, and waited, counting off the seconds in his head. The door to his office opened and the person came in, escorted by a member of Lampert's security team. With a curt nod, Lampert dismissed the guard, who closed the door behind him. The visitor was around 5'8" and strongly built, with a head that was too large by half for even his muscular frame. There was a lot contained in that overly big head, Lampert knew. The man was dressed all in black. His shoes had blocky heels to push his height up as much as possible. It was enlightening, thought Lambert, that a man that powerful still had felt compelled to artificially inflate his stature. He nodded at Lambert and sat down across from him. Good trip? The man flicked a cigarette from his shirt pocket, lit it without asking whether it was permitted or not. Lambert would not have questioned the man's decision to smoke on his floating palace. Peter Lampert did not fear many people. The man sitting across from him was one whom he did fear. A trip that ends safely at one's destination is de facto a good trip, said the other man in an accent that showed that English was not his primary language. Things are going well, said Lambert. Things could be better, said the man as he exhaled smoke and watched it float toward the elaborately carved ceiling. Things could always be better, replied Lambert, leaning forward a bit in his chair. The other man tapped his cigarette ash against the arm of his chair, letting it fall to the carpet. Lambert did not object or even react to this. Things could be better, said the man again. For example, there have been a number of killings in Paradise. The police are investigating. Your car was bombed. Again, the police are investigating. He stopped talking and stared across the width of the desk. Lambert's expression didn't change. Steps had to be taken. The fallout is what it is. The investigations will lead nowhere. He might be afraid of the man, but he could not show that fear, and Lambert could debate a point with the best of them. Your opinion that the investigation will not go anywhere, said the man, studying him closely as he bent the fired match between his two fingers. My educated opinion, based on conditions on the ground. And if you're wrong, I don't believe that I am, but if you are, there will be consequences. Of course there will be, for you. Then I have every incentive to make sure I am right. The man eased a bit to the left, making the leather seat squeak. Moving on, it's getting more difficult to acquire product. The price has to go up. You'll send this down the line. How much? 10% for now is a base. Add 5% for each category above base, meaning a 20% increase for the top tier. Yes, that's steep. It could be more, but I'm a reasonable man. I'll have to eat some of that. The man looked around at the luxurious interior of the yacht. I think you'll be just fine. I'm sure I will. So long as your educated opinion turns out to be right, money isn't everything. Lambert smiled. I would disagree with you there. Money is everything because it leads to everything else of value. Would you like to visit my boat? I have a new submarine. It can hold over 30 people. The marine life here is quite fascinating. I would like to, but demands here will prevent me. Lambert was thinking, I don't actually want to become part of the marine life. The man rose. Someone who blows up Bentleys and disappears like a wisp of smoke is someone who is formidable. It was a message. Yes, it was, perhaps more directly than you know. And you have the answer? Working on it as we speak. A small measure of advice? Lambert looked up at him unexpectedly. I'd love to hear it. Smoke often evidences a large fire that can burn out of control. He paused and put out his cigarette on the surface of Lambert's $40,000 custom-built desk. So work faster. The next moment he was gone, like a wisp of smoke blown out to sea. Chapter 64. Mako lifted his head slightly out of the water and watched the chopper lift off from the helipad and head south out to sea. He turned on his back and used small strokes of his hands to propel him closer to the boat. There was security on the main deck and two men on the pier holding MP5s. However, they had no one in the water. That was a large breach in security. But then again, the sharks would be out now. And while Lampard paid well, he apparently didn't pay that well. Mako drew close enough to the boat to touch its hull on the starboard side. He looked out to sea where the lights of the chopper were still visible. From land and with the aid of binoculars, he had caught a glimpse of the man who had first climbed off the and then climbed back on the bird. Mako had known instantly who he was. Stephen Rogers. Police around the world would pale at the name. There had never been a successful prosecution of Rogers, though many had been attempted. But when witnesses, prosecutors, and even judges are slain during the course of a trial, convictions are exceedingly rare. He had given a whole new definition to the term ruthless and would make some of the world's most worst terrorists look innocuous by comparison. He had started as an orphan on the streets of Cali and built himself into a cartel chief of near mythic proportions. Despite his modest stature, men twice his size would drop to their knees at his approach. He would kill without warning or provocation. He was not simply a sociopath who happened to be a global criminal. He was the sociopath who happened to be a global criminal. But something had come along that even Rogers had not anticipated. Rogers had watched his hemisphere's drug pipeline into America move from his native Colombia to Mexico. But then he had adapted to a new business line. He would provide the mules to move the drugs throughout the United States, and along with that he would move other valuable product, namely prostitutes and slaves. Slaves in particular with the new growth market. Forget illegal immigrants. They were expected to be free and paid at least something. Slaves expect nothing. They just hoped not to die. Everything after that was a positive for them. Not that there was much that was positive. Roger and Lambert were partners in the largest slave ring in the world, and they were poised to make it even larger, unless they were stopped. Still in the water, Mako moved down the starboard side of the ship. There was a line of portholes, low enough for him to see in. He gripped one and pulled himself partially out of the water. The room he was looking into was dark and empty. He lowered himself back into the water and moved to the next window. It was on the fourth porthole that he found something other than dark and empty. Beatrice was still dressed in her maid's uniform. She stood in one corner while Lambert sat at a table and ate his dinner. He ate slowly, chewing his food methodically. When he glanced at the bottle of wine within a few inches of his arm, Beatrice shot forward and refilled his glass. As she bent slightly forward to do so, Lambert's hand slipped to her bottom and grabbed. She didn't jerk or drop the bottle. She was apparently used to this treatment. She finished pouring the wine and retreated to the corner, her gaze downcast. A minute later, Lambert glanced at the basket of rolls. Beatrice shot forward again, picked up one roll, broke it open, and used a small knife to butter it. While she did this, Lambert cupped her left breast with his hand and snaked his other under her skirt. As she buttered the roll, Mako could see her face. Bubbling just below the surface was anguish coupled with a hatred that Mako, in all his life, had rarely seen. He saw her hand tremble ever so slightly with the knife in it. He knew what she wanted to do. Even as Lambert stroked her, she wanted to take the blade and stick it into his chest. Mako wondered why she didn't just do so. Just do it, Beatrice. Then he looked to the right and saw why she didn't. A man stood there with a gun pointed straight at Beatrice's head. She finished buttering the roll, placed it on Lambert's bread plate, set the knife down, and once more retreated to the corner. The man with the gun relaxed his stance and holstered his weapon. Mako sank back into the water. Peter J. Lambert was not a man who took chances. Mako let the current pull him away from the yacht. When he was far enough away, he struck out with long, powerful strokes. With every stroke, he imagined plunging a knife into Lambert's chest. Chapter 65. Puller was driving fast. Carson eyed him from the passenger seat. "So where are we going now? I need to see my lawyer." When they reached the street on which Griffin Mason had his law office, Puller parked the Tahoe at the curb, about 100 yards down from it. He reached into his duffel and pulled out his pair of night vision optics. and put them to his eyes. He trained them on Mason's office. Carson followed his gaze. Your lawyer? Actually, my aunt's lawyer. He's handling her estate. And how is Mason doing handling her estate? Not so good. Puller eyed the other buildings on the street. They were all dark. There was no car in Mason's driveway, no lights on in the office. How do you feel about a little breaking and entering? He asked. It's a felony. That's how I feel about it. Then you can wait here. I'll be back shortly. She grabbed his arm. Puller, think about this. You don't want to lose your military career, do you? What I want to do right by my aunt, and that includes taking a hard whack on a creep who's screwing her and others. I'll come. I can keep lookout. It wasn't fair to ask you. You have a lot bigger career to lose than I do. So don't get caught, and if you do, I'll disavow all knowledge, and I'll back that statement up 100%. You're damn right you will, soldier. A few minutes later, they were walking down the street. When they got to Mason's place, Polo hooked to left and entered the man's backyard. At the fence, he could see told Carson to wait and keep watch. This shouldn't take too long. Make sure it doesn't. Mason had a security system, but one glance through the back door window told Polo that it was not armed. The green light on the panel was lit. Polo was surprised by this. Why have a security system if you don't use it? The door lock was a deadbolt that took Puller only a few seconds to defeat using a pick gun from his duffel. He opened the door and penlighted his way to the lawyer's interior office. It took him about 30 minutes to find what he was looking for. Mason was meticulous in his record-keeping, a little too meticulous. Puller looked at the pages he had brought with him, the inventory list Mason had given him about his aunt's personal items. He checked it against the inventory list Mason had in the files. It matched down to the last item. He next searched for and found the inventory list for Cookie's estate. He ran his gaze down it. Puller saw what he knew would see. He put Cookie's inventory list in his pocket along with his aunt's. He shut the file drawer and looked around. He thought about what the other estate's attorney, Sheila Dowdy, had said. Mason's other car was an Aston Martin. He took expensive vacations. He had a big house. It was all adding up, the pieces falling into place faster and easier than was normally the case. The next moment his phone vibrated. He looked at the text. Boogie on R6, the text from Carson said. Someone had just pulled into the driveway at Mason's office. Now Puller could understand why the security system had not been engaged. This also told him that it probably wasn't Mason coming back to work. It would have armed and then disarmed the system. This was someone whom Mason did not want to give his passcode to. And maybe the person wasn't supposed to be here at all. He thumbed a text back to Carson. Description? Blue subcompact, young slender woman with blonde hair. As Puller read the text, he knew they didn't have to look for Jane Ryan anymore. She had come to them. This concludes the 8th episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. Your reader has been Chris Long.